there's always going to be a little bit of reflected energy. That reflected energy, because of a transmission line mismatch, is going to take some standing wave ratio and reflect some energy back up the helix in the wrong direction. The signal flowing in the helix in the wrong direction, the opposite from the direction the beam flows, has no effect, no problem. However, when that reflected signal gets to the input end of the helix, where you've got your input connector, and you've got another possible impedance mismatch, it makes a secondary vizoir that makes another wave reflowing forward. That secondary wave reflecting off the input end, reflowing forward, will send the tube into an extremely powerful self-oscillation. Almost every traveling wave tube, no matter how carefully designed, does a beautiful job of going into self-oscillation. Let me drop. It's a very crafty technique to solve that problem. In the middle of the helix, you put some lossy carbon granules, the aquadag material, acting as an attenuator. The net result is that the signal you send down the helix does all of its bunching action, velocity modulation, in the first half of the helix. Then that signal hits the attenuator and dies. The bunching continues to happen. The bundles of electrons get down to the tail end. They couple their electrostatic energy into that helix, and out come tens or hundreds of watts. Okay? The reflected energy that happens at the tail end of the helix creates some vizoir, starts the signal flowing back up the helix, it hits the attenuator, and dies. Ain't that classy? You make the tube long enough so it's got all the gain that you need. You put an attenuator in the middle of the helix so that any of the signal flowing forward or reverse dies, and the thing becomes stable. Very crafty. Ain't that cute? WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is a really true amplifier, you know, transistors, you know, you're putting a little voltage in, but I mean, they're physically not connected, and you got the collector and the emitter, and, you know, the base is controlling it, and, you basically have another higher voltage coming in from another source for your collector and emitter than what you do for the base. But this thing is a real true amplifier. You know, you're starting in with an RF coming in with a helical core. You know, it's going around and around and wound around this tube. And that's transmitting a signal basically to the electron gun, the beam, and by the time it gets to the end of the tube, this beam is actually inducing a higher current in the coil of the helix. I mean, this is a true amplifier, Dick.
I can tell you appreciate it, Paul. It's a very fancy piece of electronics. The basic understanding is not that bad. The way it's explained in the books will floor you. You know, piles of equations of velocity factors and coupling coefficients and whatever, focusing factors, and it'll scare the hell out of you. Principle of operation is not that bad. But with that minor amount of understanding that I have, that you're listening to, that resulted in one hell of a great big award that I got in 1990. Because the world's largest indoor anechoic chamber at the time at Edwards Air Force Base was not working correctly. I had proposed using the high-power traveling wave tubes that were on the B-1 bomber, which was sitting in the middle of that chamber, and the chamber was giving them great big echoes that they couldn't tolerate, and they couldn't find out where the echoes are coming from. And I proposed to use the bomber as a radar to test the chamber, to which they said, "You're crazy. We built the chamber to test the bomber." I said, "Why can't you use the bomber to test the chamber?" All we had to do is to put quarter of a nanosecond pulses at 10 gigahertz, for instance, into the traveling wave tube, which means that the tube itself had a helix inside that was 16 feet long. If you stretched it all out, 16 feet long, 16 nanoseconds of delay inside the tube, and I'm putting in a quarter of a nanosecond RF pulse at 10 gigs. wicks I was putting into the tube. I was only lighting up the first turn of the helix, and the rest of the turns of the helix had nothing. The tube had a little bit lower gain when you used it that way, but it still produced full power output. And I proposed to do that, to which they said, no, you can't do that. It won't work. I said, try it. You'll like it. The bottom line is...
Repeater, time out.
The bottom line is it worked. I was able to make quarter nanosecond pulses at high power out of that tube. Only one tube in three, by the way, had the right correction of the aqueduct coating was done with a smooth enough manner so it didn't make reflections, if you know what I mean. So the purity of the pulse coming out, only one tube in three could do it, but that was good enough. We had a lot of those tubes. And so I was able to produce full power output from that tube coming out of the airplane. A quarter of a nanosecond pulse, when it goes into space, is only 3 or 4 inches from front to back. So I was probing this 300-foot chamber, 300-foot left and right, if you know what I mean, is the size of the chamber. I was probing it a third of a foot at a time, and I could find each reflecting object in that chamber. If somebody had dropped a nail, if somebody had dropped an adapter somewhere in that chamber, I could look at that echo and pin it down to the nearest third of a foot and tell you where it was. And by slowly rotating the airplane on the turntable in the middle of the chamber, it was the equivalent of waving a flashlight around the chamber. So we looked at the echoes as we waved the flashlight around the chamber, and I could tell you how many feet out was each one of those echoing devices. Lots of people were telling me at the time, hey, this guy is crazy. He thinks he's going to get full power out of the tube doing that. When we finally did it, a number of classy people said, hey, the guy who says he can do it should, the guy who says it can't be done should get out of the way of the guy who's doing it. And so I got a great big award in 1990 for doing that with this minor understanding of how a traveling wave tube works. WS2N, K2LIW.
My business stick. Very good. Very well done. I appreciate it. I mean, I've heard him discuss that many times. The thought crossed my mind, and it goes out. And then tonight, I thought of asking that question, and you answered it very well. Back to that.
Yeah, it cost Rockwell $63 million to build that chamber. And this was the qualifying procedure that solved the problem, so to speak. They had spent 6 months looking for the echoes in the chamber and couldn't find them. And this technique allowed them to find them. Because at the end of 6 months, there was no end in sight. They had to do something different. And so they brought in this crazy guy from the East Coast who made some pronouncements. And at the end of that procedure, when I was about to get that award, one of the key Air Force people who was in charge of the chamber said, hey, Dick, you're pretty good at tuning up chambers. How many of them have you tuned? To which I said, I've been ready for it all my life. This is my first. And it happened to be the biggest one in the world. Quite a crazy coincidence, as you can tell. The right person at the right time with a crazy idea that happened to work. And the big echoes that were happening in the chamber that they couldn't tolerate was the anechoic material on the floor that had to be removed. It took me a week to convince them to take the stuff off the floor so the floor became reflective in order to make the chamber absorptive. Of course, that sounds crazy. It worked. Okay, I know we're way off center here, but RF, as you can tell, is crazy stuff. The way a radio wave propagates in space, the way it gets absorbed inside of a chamber, the way it acts inside of a traveling wave tube, the way it acts inside of an antenna, the fact that those antennas on that aeroplane, were broadband enough, they were an octave broad, so therefore they could reproduce a pulse that was a quarter of a nanosecond long, 250 picoseconds, three cycles of a 10 gig signal would go into that antenna, the antenna would properly... Looks like we're running out of time. This was TechNet number 1453. Hey, John, say some words. Casey...
WCD, KQLIW,
heading, John.
Okay, and that's the eastern link, because, of course, we lost the west.
Understood. Very good. Yeah, he did a great job at explaining the traveling wave tube. Plus, I had a little diagram in front of me. I never got it. Now I got it.
Yeah, I found that extremely interesting because I've known about them, but I've never worked with them. And it was interesting to find out how they actually do work. And, you know, it just makes you wonder if it was $150,000 and let's say another $1 million to install it, when you look at the price of a spacecraft, it's just amazing they didn't put it in there. But then, listening to what you said, they didn't expect it to last 35 years, so it's all right.
Oh, yeah. I mean, everything was redundancy. I mean, even the Spirit and Opportunity. Okay, Spirit quit 3 months, no, 3 years ago on Mars. But, I mean, they sent both, you know, two of them up there. All right, Curiosity, they knew the budget, you know, was getting low, so they sent that by itself. But, you know, they got another one planned just like it coming up in a couple of years.
Well, I think what you should do is find out what it actually costs to send that up there. And divide that up by 90 days. That's what they expected it. So you'd know how many dollars per day. And then multiply that dollar figure by the amount of days it actually operated. I think you'd see a big bang for the buck.
Yeah, I think Dick mentioned something like that years ago. He compared it to manned missions. You know, what would it cost? You know, all right, a guy could probably, you know, do quite a few different projects a lot quicker than a robot could, but you know, day in, day out, 24 hours a day. I mean, you know, even during the nighttime, they got these things thinking and doing things. During the winter cycle, they got them doing things, and they report during the springtime. I mean, you know, year in, year out. Who wants, you know, hey, the other thing, Voyager, 35 years almost, and this thing is 10 years. You know, before you know it, this thing might be 30 years.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I wondered, on those Mars missions where those solar collectors were getting covered with dust, you would think that they would have an elevator to lift those to dump the dust off of them. But evidently, the winds on Mars keep blowing them clean after the winter, so I guess that's what's keeping those older ones going. Very interesting.
Yeah, they watch the average drop all the time, you know, when they get covered with dust, and then a little breeze comes through, a dust devil or whatever, and next thing you know, it's clean again, and the average comes right back up again. This has been going on forever now, for years. So, and they, again, they thought 3 months, that was it, you know, and they would have been happy with that. And a lot of people thought, well, maybe you could put a blower on. Some kind of windshield wiper type of thing, but you know, everything is adds to the complication of operating on Mars. It adds weight, you know, every little thing they want to cut back on, and they never really figured that much on the wind blowing the dust off. I mean, that was a real surprise, as I remember.
Oh yeah, that was a blessing in disguise. They probably didn't even think of that. And, well, just goes to show you, those guys at NASA and JPL and all these guys that are involved, they have so many things to think of and so many different ways to check. So when you hear about a motor going bad, you know, it's really acceptable because look at how far we sent it, the stress it's under, those strange conditions that we really don't know. So I think they're doing extremely well.
Oh, I agree. And they come, you know, I mean, they come down to the wire. Every time a problem comes up, they have a way around it, work around it. I mean, they've cut off so many different pieces of equipment on Voyager, shut them down little by little, you know, just to keep it functioning, to, you know, get, you know, just the important information coming through. There's no more camera. You know, they keep cutting back on heaters and whatever it is, and to God, a list of about 10 or 12 different things they've shut down over the years just to make up for that 4.7 watts they keep losing every year. You know, I mean, for them to come up with this, you know, I mean, it's remarkable, the way they can keep something like that going year in, year out. So, we'll see. There's a lot of other missions. New Horizon, although that's not planned on going out of the solar system. That's going to go in orbit around the sun, and after it leaves Pluto, it's not going to orbit, just going to pass it, and it's going to go into the Kuiper Belt. But they have long-term plans for that, too, but again, if it makes it past Pluto, it's a success, and then they have what they call extended missions. WS
CC2WGB. Well, what's the approximate size of the Voyager craft? Do you know?
Yeah, I believe the antenna is 12 meters, about 12 feet in diameter. And that thing takes up about half of it. So it's, I don't know, it's maybe 15 feet high, and probably is much wide, but they do have a long arm sticking out to keep the magnetrons away from the they have three RTGs, radio isotope thermoelectric generators on board, and they don't want those things to affect the magnetrons. So that's all the way at the end of a boom. That's probably about 20 feet away.
Yeah, aerodynamically, looking at those craft, some of them are really ugly, but they do function. So, yeah, it was great hearing about that the space report and all of the stuff that's going on. And, you know, Dick is right. I haven't heard much about the Chinese attempts, whether they've all been successful or if they've had any failures. I imagine they have, but maybe they're not transmitting them. But always interesting stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Chinese, they're going to try to do everything on their own, you know. They don't have any partners involved, so they're going to have a tough battle. But, I mean, they're coming along. I mean, they copy everybody's stuff. You know, I mean, they copy the Russians, Soyuz, spacecraft and all of that. So what are you going to do? But they, you know, if you look up their program, they do have a space station, and you research that. I think it was 901. I forget what it is, but I'll think of it in a second. But this has been going on for a long time. We don't get much of, you know, information. The news on, I mean, you'll see a little clip. Maybe that's about it.
Yeah, and I'm surprised because, you know, they're supposedly up and coming, and you think they'd... But, you know, maybe it's a good thing that they're copying basically our stuff and the Russian stuff, that maybe the docking ports might be compatible with ours, and someday maybe they can participate with us.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, sooner or later they're going to have to come around. They are out there by themselves. They want their own moon program. They want their own space station. You know, there's only so much you're going to go on like that. You know, you can't keep going like that.
Yeah, I'm sure they could save quite a few bucks if they would come on board with the rest of the free world. But maybe they want to, you know, stagger on their own for a while just to see if they could do it. But I think it would be much better if we pooled our resources. We could probably get a lot further, a lot faster. At least that's the way it appears with the Russians. It just, I resent the fact that we have to pay the Russians so much for those lifts. And pretty soon we'll have our craft back again, maybe, what, in another 5 years? And we'll be able to make our own lifts again.
you're going to have, well, you'll have two of them. You'll have Dragon and Dream Chaser. And, you know, they'll be able to put them up to the space station instead of spending now up to $73 million, I think it is, for them to do it instead of what is it? It used to be $50 million a couple of years ago. So the price keeps going up and up, up and up. I think they call it 915. 915 Chinese space program. I think if you put that into Google, you come up with their programs, all the different programs. 915, I think it has to do with the date that they started all this.
You know, Paul, I heard you mention another rocket that we're going to be building that's going to be larger than the Saturn V. How much larger is that going to be? I never thought we'd do that ever again.
Space launch system, yeah, that's going to be, well, Saturn V was 7.5, this will be over that, 8 point something. And, you know, when I say 7.5, that's 7.5 million pounds of thrust. So, there you go. You put, you're going to be able to put anything in orbit you want. I mean, forget it. I mean, if you want to send something to Mars, no problem. We'll send up a habitat vehicle, then we'll send up an Orion spacecraft and link them together. And you want to send them to Mars, you'll be able to do that.
Also, maybe in the future, they're going to go with a rocket like that to place a rocket in orbit that they can use for interplanetary travel and deliver these modules and things that are going to be required. We could put a station orbiting Mars and have people visiting that and locking up new module systems. And I know that's going to be expensive, but I believe that's probably the way they're going to go.
There's a lot of different things proposed. Going to get very involved, but the first things you'll see, if we live that long, is asteroid return mission. They'll send out the space launch system robotically to get a piece of an asteroid and bring it back and put it in orbit around the moon. After doing that, they'll send another one up, manned, and we'll fly people to put in either orbit around the moon or to the L2. They're thinking about the L2 section, the Lagrange 2. That's not between us and the moon, but between us, us, moon, and then after that. And they think that they eventually could settle this asteroid in that location, and we'll go out and meet it and find out about spacesuit. A spaceship with a spacesuit and take pieces of it and bring it into the spacecraft and bring pieces back. So, I mean, these are long-range plans. I've seen their animation on the computer. It's actually been approved. I mean, they're working on this idea. I mean, there's money put toward doing this.
I don't know if you read the article. There was an article about 6 months ago about placing a telescope on the dark side of the moon and make it modular construction as far as power and cooling, whatever they needed, so that it could be repaired by just delivering a module up there. Have you ever heard about something like that?
You know, Carl Sagan he proposed doing that probably in the late 1980s, thinking that the dark side of the moon would be great place for a telescope location, but to have it where, you know, it's serviceable, unmanned and all that, I haven't read anything about that, but it's good to hear because I always thought that was a good idea.
I guess they probably have to put some kind of a repeater system or an orbiting satellite to be able to communicate with the telescope, something like that. You know, I'm sure they've thought it all out, but I don't think that would be as expensive as a moon landing. So maybe they'll proceed with that, because I think we could get some great pictures from the dark side of the moon with something like the hole stuck there, or something even bigger. Awesome.
I know, that's why they need something at the L2 position, the Lagrange 2, because, you know, it doesn't have to orbit the moon. I mean, essentially it's orbiting the Earth once every month, but it's on the dark side of the moon. You can have a communication satellite out there permanently. And they're thinking about eventually some kind of space station in that location, too. But, I mean, even a satellite for communication would be great, because any transmissions, either manned or unmanned, from the dark side of the moon could, you know, you beam it up to this satellite, 23,000, well, actually it won't be 23,000, it'll be less than that, but probably about 10,000 miles up. And I forgot what the number is. Maybe it's more than that. No, it has to do with the Lagrange point. I mean, I think it's like 30,000. 30, I mean, it's a good distance from the moon. But whatever it is, it's in one location. I forgot the distance. I know Lagrange point 2 for Sun, Earth, Lagrange point 2 is 1 million miles. I forgot what the Lagrange point 2 for Earth, Moon, and Lagrange point 2 would be. But whatever it is, you could have a permanent satellite there. That would be great.
Well, the Lagrange point between Earth and Moon has to be roughly at what, about 150,000 miles, a little more than halfway?
No, I forgot the number. I thought it was 30 or 40,000, but, and then whatever it is, that would be L1 between us and the moon, and then L2 is beyond that, the same distance, but on the dark side of the moon. Then there's a 4 and a 5, no, wait, correction, not a 4, a 3 and a 4, yeah, there's a 3 and a 4 there, they're at like 60 degree angles between the two.
All I know is if they keep going, we won't be able to navigate up to the traffic light with all this stuff whizzing around. It's amazing they get up there without getting hit with all of these things that are flying around between tools and parts and broken satellites. It's incredible. I look at that NORAD chart and I just scream.
Okay, very good. Yeah, oh yeah, that it looks like a cloud around the Earth. But no, yeah, okay, I remember now. It's 5 points. There's Lagrange point 1, that's between. But use Sun and the Earth as an example, and then you could do the same thing for Earth and Moon, or any two orbital planets. Between the Sun and the Earth, Lagrange point 2 is 1 million miles between the two. 1 million miles off of Earth, so 1 million miles the opposite side of Earth. That's Lagrange point 2. 3 is on the other side of the Sun. Forget it. I mean, that's like 100 million miles away. You know, forget it. That's far, far away. But then 4 and 5 are set at 60 degree angles, either forward in the forward rotation between the planetary object around the main star, in this case the Sun, or following. I think it's 60 degrees behind. So the same thing for Earth and Moon. So you're going to have Lagrange point 1, I think you're right, probably 40, 50, 60,000 miles between Earth and Moon. And then you're going to have, on the dark side of the Moon, that would be Lagrange point 2. 3 would be opposite side of Earth in reference to the Moon. And then 4 would be, I think, 60 degrees in the forward motion of the direction of the moon, and then 60 degrees behind it would be 5. And there's a lot of talk about eventually setting up a colony at L5. They like that position because it's kind of like between the moon and the Earth, and it's very stable. You need very little power to keep a spacecraft or a space city at Alpha 5. Or, you know, or L4 for that money. But for some reason they like L5.
Well, I remember Flash Gordon. I'm sure you remember that. When he talked about the city in space that was traveling around. It looks like we're not too far from that date. I mean, I may never see it, but it's surely coming. That's a definite. But, yeah, some interesting stuff is going to be happening in the next 50 years. And the knowledge we're gathering, we better get some more educated people to decipher some of this information. Otherwise, we're going to be bogged.
More people getting up there, too. You know, I mean, since the space station has been put up, I think that something like, what is it, 400 visits, I think, of people to the space station. That's a big number. I mean, you know, there's a lot of people are repeat, so it's like, you know, 200 or 300 of the same people going to the space station. And now you got, you know, guys like Virgin Atlantic. He's got the, it's called Virgin Galactic for their space launches. And they're going to be suborbital, but legally these people will be going to space. They'll experience about 10 minutes of weightlessness, and then they'll come back. It's, you know, you might have, you know, going four or six people at a time every couple of weeks going up. I mean, the numbers are just going to add up phenomenally.
Well, I know the space elevator is probably quite a distance away. It may come to happening, I don't know. But it seems that the gun rail that they're talking about, we may be able to set up our cargo vessels and accelerate them and put them up in orbit so we don't have to pay so much for fuel. We just have to send the men up to unload them and dock them or whatever, and we could have them all just hanging out up there. That will be a big step forward in the space program. I hope they get that done.
Oh, yeah. I went to a seminar, it's got to be 10 years ago, at Stony Brook, and they had a bunch of people talking, physicists, people like this, in that field, and one guy talked about the space elevator. Brought up the point that I think it's like $10,000 per pound at that time to put, you know, people into orbit, you know, any kind of people, water, dumbass, into orbit, $10,000 per pound, you know, whatever we're talking about, you know, it could be a ham sandwich that weighs a pound, $10,000, and then now they're getting it down to, you know, they're probably down to 7,000. The number's coming down little by little. But the space elevator would bring it down to less than $1,000 per pound. So, I mean, you get anything that low, I mean, it would be just extremely economical to do it. So you're 100% right. But doing that project is, you know, who knows how much you got to spend to build a space elevator. But, you know, even unmanned, I mean, it would be a tremendous, tremendous feat. I mean, it would just be the eighth wonder of the world, I guess.
Well, what it requires is some more breakthroughs in scientific discoveries, which may come out of the Hadron Collider, or you know, some of these brilliant guys thinking up systems. Because right now we're working with systems that haven't changed too much, although the designs have been improved. Once they take that next step, that's where you're going to see the big savings, I believe.
I often thought if you could put a Hadron Collider in space, I mean, you know, even like a linear one, and shoot these particles out the back at the speed of light, that's tremendous. I mean, I think the ion engines are something like 80,000 miles per hour. I mean, that's how fast the photons get shot out, the xenon photons. But if you could put a particle accelerator, which, I mean, it's cost prohibitive. prohibitive because it's too expensive to put in space, all these big magnets and everything. But if you can get something up there where you're going to shoot protons out of the back of your spacecraft at the speed of light, now you've got something.
Oh, yeah, because of the mass of the protons. But, you know, don't forget, the big thing with the collider is keeping it cool. I think they would have a lot easier time keeping it cool in space than we do on Earth. So maybe that would diminish the size. But you're right. Can you imagine the speed that thing could attain? Oh, unbelievable.
Yeah, I didn't think of that. That's the biggest cost is the refrigeration for the superconducting magnets, practically. That they chill those things down. And the magnets, still have to launch the magnets, which is nothing but coils. They have a nuclear power system powering the coils. And, sounds good. Shoot those things out at the speed of light instead of 80,000 miles an hour like the ion engines. Ion engines are good. I mean, we got a lot of them up there right now working. In fact, you got one going between the different asteroids, Cirrus and Vista, in orbit around Cirrus, around Vista, and now it's going to go around Cirrus in another year or two, I think 2015, and all on ion engines. So, I mean, they're coming a long way with that. I mean, they're in practical use. What we need now is a speed of light engine, and you can get that with an accelerator.
Oh, there's so many exciting things going on. We're going to be landing on asteroids, sampling, maybe taking chunks of them and bringing them back. Maybe we'll find a couple made out of gold. That'd be interesting. Also, is there any word on that asteroid that's headed for us sort of in November, around that time period? Is there any updates on that?
Is that the ISIS one, ISIS, is that one? I think that's, there's a difference. That this one I'm thinking about is the one that came within 8 million miles or from the Earth. That was ISIS. I think you're thinking of the other one that's going to be going to 700,000 miles off the surface of the sun. I'm trying to think of the name of it, but that's the one that's supposed to be the comet of the century. Is that the one you're thinking about?
Yeah, the one that's going to pass by the sun. I'm just wondering. I didn't know it was a comet. I thought it was an asteroid. And I'm just wondering if they've got the trajectory so accurate that it will maybe orbit the sun, or may it crash into the sun. Not that it would make any difference to us, probably, because of the size, it won't really matter. But I think that flyby is going to be something to photograph.
I heard it's supposed to be as bright as the moon. I don't know. Probably not the diameter of the moon, of course. You know, that's about a half-inch arc, half-degree arc. But as bright as the moon, I mean, if that's true, that will be, I mean, that's going to be Halley or Hale-Bopp by a mile. So we'll have to wait and see. And I haven't read much about it except on the internet. I have not seen a magazine. I haven't been buying that magazine. They're so expensive, but I haven't found anything that really says that this thing is going to make it around the sun 100%. Everything I read, it could break up and wind up, you know, decaying into the sun.
Yeah, similar to what happened to Jupiter. Yeah, that's what I think might happen. It's close. You know, I wrote down a question I had for Dick, and I forgot to ask him tonight. I had the other mailbag stuff, and I forgot my own question. Crazy thing. Well, I guess we'll find out in November. I'm going to have a camera ready. I'm going to try to prepare a camera to be able to get some shots of that. Because I remember seeing Hale-Bopp, and it was... It was more like a blurry image. It wasn't really a sharp comet, not like Halley. Hale-Bopp was more like a blurry image.
Yeah, I remember that one as well. That's the same one that the Heaven's Gate people killed themselves with. By 40 people, I think, took their own life. What was that? They thought the aliens were behind it or something. I don't know. The Halley's, I never even saw Halley's. I looked for it. I never saw it. But I'm not going to make the next one either. So this one should be good. I'd like to, I forgot the name. I'll have to look that up on the internet. I cannot remember the name. I have no idea. But it shouldn't be too hard to find.
Yeah, when you get a chance, look that up. If you have time next week, maybe there's an update on it. You could give us some more. I know they were saying it was ablating at a specific amount, and it's probably going to increase as it approaches us and gets nearer to the sun. So I wonder if there's going to be enough of it left to really appreciate it visually.
Yeah, I mean, the latest prediction was it's going to be the comet of the century. So we'll see. What was your question for Dick? Was it an antenna question or something more mundane? I had one in case he didn't have any questions. I had a question for him, but I figured I had a backup in case there was nobody. But there's always somebody. So I wanted to find out if they were going to relocate all those antennas for TV from the Empire State Building to the new spire on the new World Trade Center. Sure, that's a ways away. I mean, they just spire up, but just wondering if they're going to do that. How much of a difference is that going to make in TV reception for broadcast? I have that. I have an outdoor antenna. I have both. My main reception is cable, but I like the idea of having the cable in case I have a power failure, or sometimes I just like to play around listening to broadcast TV. Back to you there, John. WS2N.
KC2WGB. That's a good question. Eric should know. KC2EJ. He probably would know if they're prepping for that. It sounds, I believe there's plenty of room up there in that spire. But I haven't heard of anybody building any special antennas for it. Yeah, good question. Maybe Dick does know. My question was going to be, I wondered, and I was talking to Wesley, I don't know what happened to Wesley tonight. He seemed to disappear. The question was, what do they use for proton detection? I don't know of a proton detector.
Well, I don't know. I mean, starting out, they had those, didn't they have those cloud, some kind of cloud boxes when they started, and that led to today's accelerated, what was that, electron? I think they were doing protons in that, right? They had some kind of a cloud inside of a glass box. I can't remember what the cloud was made of. And as they would fly these protons through it, they would see the path that they were taking. Am I right?
That was a cloud chamber. In fact, I have one of those. It's basically like a fish aquarium, and you put a chunk of dry ice in the bottom of it, and the cosmic rays, when they penetrate, you can see a trace. And they developed other things after that, but that's what they used for years.
Okay, then they use that for proton detection as well? I mean, is that how it came about?
I'm not sure. I don't remember any instrument that comes to mind that could detect protons. I'm sure there is one, but I'm just not aware of it.
Yeah, I always thought it was a cloud type of device that got the whole thing started, and then they said, okay, now let's make it bigger and take pictures. And how they do it now, I have no idea, but I mean, these gigantic rooms, 20, 30, 40, 50, 50 feet in diameter, that's doing all that work. You know, it's not a cloud chamber, I know that, but it's probably, you know, all comes from that research.
Yeah, a friend of mine worked on that cave where they put all those photomultiplier tubes that count neutrinos. I don't know if they were ever successful. I believe they were, but that's what they were using. And I believe they can detect cosmic rays also, but both of those are very energetic particles.
Yeah, I know. That's we had that on the net one night about the one down in the Antarctica that they built in the ice. So, very good, John. I'm going to turn in. So I'll let you go. Sounds like your health got straightened out. I hope it did. It was last week. You might comment on that if you want. And I'll turn it back to you, WS2S.
Okay, Paul. Yeah, no, I'm doing well. Feeling well. Thanks for asking. But, you know, I got a little scrape on my foot from when I was, when I passed out and I was flailing around in the room. My leg had hit the bed frame and cut up my leg a little bit. So I got a couple of marks there that's healing. But other than that, everything seems to be going well. Well, you enjoy the morning. Have fun. And I will talk to you on that. Sir, KC2WGB.
Very good, John. 73. And by the way, you're definitely quieting into this machine. It's a good night for you. 73, John. KC2WGB, WS2N, will be clear.
KC2WGB clear.
on, so now you're coming back up. Stand by, Wesley. Okay, now you're much better now, John. So, and Wesley, okay, well, he called you about quarter after, but you're busy with the promise and what he goes up. I mean, priorities, that's it. John, over to you, KC2 WGB, WS2M, we got Wesley on.
Yeah, I heard him in there a couple of times. I don't know what happened, but I'm here in the Eastern Link excellent tonight. I don't know if Eric did any work out there, but it's coming in here gangbusters. Yes, Wes, no problem. Now, you did the right thing. Business comes first. Let me see. Are you transmitting on 375-975? Okay, so you're going through the link. No problem, I can hear you.
Sure. KC2 WGB. QSY.